Έτσι είναι η νεολαία όμως σήμερα. Δεν είναι διατεθειμένη να ιδρώσει, να ματώσει τα χεράκια της για να γίνει δουλειά. Εμείς το χτίζουμε με τα χέρια μας αυτό το μέρος. Α, δεν σας είδα. Καλησπέρα. Είμαι ο Μάκης Παπασμακόπουλος και όπως ενδέχεται να βλέπετε ή να ακούτε ή να βλέπετε και να ακούτε, βρισκόμαστε σε ένα γιαπί. Το γιαπί αυτό είναι το στούντιο της Sacred Belt. Installments.
Recordings.
Sacred Belt Recordings. Να έχουμε και κάτι να φάμε τώρα. Τι σας ήθελα. Πριν από λίγο καιρό, είχαμε κάνει μια συνέντευξη με τον Άγγλο κωμικό Ράσελ Χάουαρντ στο πλαίσιο της επικείμενής του εμφάνισης στο θέατρο Βέμπο το Σάββατο 3 Μαΐου, Καρόλου 18 στην Αθήνα, όχι εμείς, το Βέμπο. Live 2025 Europe Tour. Ο Ράσελ Χάουαρντ για πρώτη φορά στην Ελλάδα. Η συνέντευξη που θα παρακολουθήσετε έχει γίνει πάλι σε κατάσταση για ποιο το στούντιο της Sacred Belt Holdings.
Recordings.
Οπότε είναι λίγο μαύρο, λίγο καταθλιπτικό, λίγο πρόχειρα στημένο, αλλά μήπως μαύρο και καταθλιπτικό δεν είναι και το τοπίο της ψυχής ενός κωμικού, έτσι δεν είναι, ναι. Απολαύστε τη συνέντευξη και μείνετε συνέντευξη. Πάρτε κανένα στήρο μετά από τον άνθρωπο. Δεν έχετε τσάμπα. Κοστίζουν αυτά. Πτήσεις, ξενοδοχεία, φαγητά.
Hi, Russ. How you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Not bad at all. So it's an absolute pleasure to speak to you. I've been a massive fan for a long, long time. It's a weird one because we're pretty close in as an age, and it's almost like it's weird to sort of see a comedian that you always thought as someone you kind of grow up with reach the stardom that you have.
Oh, how weird. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's almost like it's, I know it's a weird thing to say, but it's almost like you kind of, it feels like you're one of us and you've kind of risen to a great level of success. And it's almost like you tend to feel proud about someone you don't really know, which is a weird one. You know what I mean?
No, I do know that. Yeah. It's that funny thing of like, I have that with footballers. So like, I was very lucky to meet, a load of I did Soccer Aid, and I'm a big Liverpool fan.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
got to spend time with like Jamie Carragher, and it's that weird thing because I feel like, you know, I've watched him, and I've watched him when he was a kid, and now I see him as like a commentator, and it's a similar thing. And even though I think Carragher's like 5 years older than me, there's still that weird sense of you've grown up with them. I know what you mean. It's unusual, isn't it? It's sort of, it's funny. I don't know why that is, but there is more, there's more of a connection because it's that thing of, it's a bit like when you go out on the beers with like one of your cousins and they're now 35 and you're like, I remember you when you were a baby. So it's kind of, that's essentially what you're saying to me is you're like, I've seen you naked on a potty.
And yeah, well, kind of, yeah. But it's the same, just minus the beers, you know, that's...
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's you mentioning famous footballers is another thing I really wanted to ask you because it's another weird thing with comedians because they're people that make you laugh and laughter is such an important part of being alive and the quality of life. It's very different than other levels of stardom in the sense that a footballer or a musician or a famous actor, you feel that there's this gap between the performer and you as a member of the audience. When someone makes you laugh, it's almost like that space gets smaller. Growing up as a performer, does that make you sometimes feel uncomfortable about the ease with which people are willing to sort of come near you and say, "Oh, Russell, you're great, you make us laugh so much"?
No, because it's sort of, particularly in England, I kind of, we're so, it takes so much courage to to take off the shackles of being English and go up to somebody and say that you like them, that I love it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's not something that comes easy to English people to be, because not because we don't like being nice. I think we go around with this fear of like, I better not say something because that person will think I'm a dick. Like we have that. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
I better not say
that I like his comedy because then he'll think I'm an idiot. So we're kind of in this, we're in our own headspace. I've done this loads with comedians I admire, but I'm like, oh God, should I go over there? Should I not? I don't want to spoil their day. Yeah. And you realize the unfortunate truth is that arrogance and shyness look exactly the same.
Yes, it does actually. That's very true.
Because you just sat there and it's all, we're all in each other's head. So if somebody has the courage to kind of break this tension and say, hey man, I think you're great, it's a lovely thing. Do you know what I mean? And I genuinely don't take it for granted. And I love having a conversation with people because it's the kind of thing I would say if I saw Jurgen Klopp, right? Mm-hmm. It's a good example. I was on holiday in Australia.
Did you see his teeth before you saw the person? Because they're kind...
Yeah, but when I saw the teeth, it was magnificent. But I saw him from behind. And I was with my wife and son on a balcony. And I said to her, I was like, that is Jurgen Klopp. And she was like, what are you talking about? And I ran out the door because I knew it was him. I'm such a huge fan. And I just couldn't pass up the opportunity to let him know. And the fear that was going through my heart that he was going to be like, fuck off, I'm on holiday. You know what I mean? I just thought, right, I have to go through this. And then we ended up having a 10-minute conversation because clearly he recognized that it was a nice thing to do.
Exactly.
And I said, listen, man, thank you so much. I'm a big fan. You gave me so many memories and I don't want to spoil your day. I just want you to know this. And I've seen a few people do it where they're kind of they're arrogant and they're kind of mean to people that have said nice things to them. And it just, from a karmic point of view, you think, why would you put that out there?
It
makes no sense to me. But particularly as a comic, because every comedian had a comedian they loved or comedians that they loved when they were young. So I just don't know why you'd piss all over your 15-year-old self. That's what it feels like. Do you know what I mean? You just kind of going, everyone has that giddiness, you know?
It's interesting that you mentioned the word courage quite a few times, because I wanted to touch upon that, because it seems to be a trait that is even more important for comedians these days, because the world is more divided than it's ever been. And it's almost like the only real voices online seem to be the extremes. Do you think it takes even more courage these days to go up on a stage and make jokes about stuff that people are just waiting to be offended by?
I always think of that thing whenever I think about, you know, jokes. But that scene in Curb Your Enthusiasm when Larry David's wife says, why did you say that? Because he says something that, you know, goes down badly at a dinner party, and he looks at her and goes, I took a chance. And I think it's just the thrift of that it explains so deeply the psychology of a comedian. It's this weird, you know, it's like, what makes you step on stage when you've seen other people die on their ass? And, you know, like you're at a festival gig, there's 20,000 people there and all the other comics are dying. What madness is there in our head that goes, I'll be fine?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
It's not going to happen to me.
but totally. It's like, I'll take a chance, it'll be fine. But it's that, I think it's like, I took a chance, or I couldn't live with myself if I didn't. It's that thing where it's so, we as comedians feel like we can break the tension. We can pop the bubble that, and that's what we try. We try to think of jokes and words and things that make everyone laugh and go, fucking.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
So it's sort of, you know, we don't always get it right. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? That I think, you know, I think there's a difference between like an analysis of a special and an analysis of a comedian in a comedy room. Because like, if you see somebody in a comedy room and there's something that you might find offensive, the thing about it is that that might not be the final version of how they're going to say it. But we sort of now live in a world where with camera phones, it could be like, that's it.
And just the nugget of it.
That's it. And it becomes instantly tangible, where comedy is kind of always intangible until the comic has deemed it finished enough for him to present. And I think that's a big change, that the space to fail is so vital. And you just have to find those places where you can just go and fail. And, you know, huge comics fail. And this part of it, you know, like Chris Rock goes down to the Cellar and fails. Seinfeld fails. You know, Michelle Wolf fails. Because that's part of the process.
But doesn't that bracket of failure become smaller the more famous you get? And I'll explain how I'm thinking about it. It's like, I'm sure that when you were an up-and-coming comedian and you were stepping out on the stage and stages that no one knew you, there was an apprehension there. But I'm guessing that the more famous you get and the more shows that you put on where people come and they know they're coming to see you, that bracket of failure becomes smaller and smaller. Does that take some of the adrenaline and the excitement out of it sometimes?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's, I don't think it necessarily takes the excitement. It probably takes the adrenaline out a wee bit, because you kind of go, I think this is going to be okay. They know who I am. Okay, yeah. Fine. But it's probably a bit like, to bring it back to football, it's probably a bit like how Steven Gerrard felt when he was, you know, 30, stepping onto the pitch at Anfield. He kind of, the audience knew what he, the crowd knew what he could do, and he knew what he could do. And he really wanted to impose himself on that pitch. It's a bit like that, really. So you kind of, as opposed to when Gerrard was 11 and he was, you know, he was good.
An up-and-comer,
I mean, like, it's kind of, there's going to be a bit, can I do it? Fuck, will it work? And you can sometimes be paralyzed a bit by that. Will it work? Will it work? Will it work? And then it's a, you know what it's like. It's a really lovely feeling when you get to that stage where you kind of, there's a phrase we have in the UK when you're like, oh, he's found his voice.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And do you know what I mean? And that moment where you kind of, you feel comfortable in your own skin and you found your groove, it can take a really long time. Mm-hmm. So that's what, to the long answer to your question of like whether you lose the excitement or the adrenaline, it's kind of like some of us spend quite a long time tuning the guitar. So by the time you've got it, you really want to fucking, like, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, hope you enjoy this. It took me 15 years to figure it out. But do you know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Once you've, and that's what it's like. That's what it like feels like being a comedian. It's like you've built your own instrument, and you had to show it to the audience, and you had to figure out how to play it, and that takes so long. So when you're able to play your own instrument and master it, it's a great feeling, and you want that to continue for as long as possible. And then there will be that inevitable moment where people are like, fucking hell, I'm fed up with this instrument. Christ, can he not learn another one? And you'll have to find something else, you know?
Moving on from that, there's another element to your trajectory of your career so far, in as much as a lot of people got to know you through television and a very particular type of comedy. And then you kind of bloomed into this social commentary side of your act, which I find even more interesting, because it kind of, I think that required a lot more courage, because your humor to begin with was sort of approachable from all sides, or to an extent. I mean, not completely, but as soon as you kind of went into that social commentary, political commentary side of it, I'm sure there must have been a part of you that said, what am I losing here? What can I lose? Like, are people going to lose part of the audience because they're not keen on what I'm commentating on? Or did that come into the equation?
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because like most, like I remember having a really interesting conversation with Tim Minchin and Roisin Conaty, both great comics. Well, Tim's more than just a great comic, anyway.
Yeah,
but we were sort of talking about a thing of like you, where you have to follow your own nose and you have to notice what you're talking about to your friends.
Yeah,
and then if what you're interested in and what you're talking about with your friends doesn't appear in your act, then you're not doing you. Do you know what I mean? And it was sort of, I was talking about this. I remember reading this article that like one in four girls were self-harming for age 16 to 25, one in four girls. I was like, fuck it. I remember reading and going, what the fuck? You know? And so I asked Roisin and I asked loads of my kind of female friends and they're all like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. And I was like, fucking hell. And it felt like such, I was so shocked by it. I was so shocked by the response of, you know, all the women in my life going, yeah, that makes sense. That I just felt compelled to try and unravel it, as it were. So I kind of followed my own nose and, you know, tried to write stand up about that. But that's the way I've always been, really. So it wasn't really a difference. It's just that my interests got slightly, they just changed. And I felt like that people trusted me enough that I could talk about it, you know. And but I've definitely got sort of spikier and a bit more sort of devil may care the older I've got, which, you know, is probably not to my sort of, I mean, economic advantage. I could probably make more money if I was a bit more palatable.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of super lucky that I'm fine and I've done fine. So I don't feel like, I really like people liking me and I really like making people laugh, but I also have to stay true to the things I want to talk about, you know? So that's always been my thing, really, of kind of what am I interested in? And I try to really focus on things that make me laugh rather than oh, this will work. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Saying that, I saw, I can't remember the name of the podcast, but there was this great podcast that you were talking on. I think it's The Comedian's Comedian.
Right.
Yeah, I think so. That was it. And there was a very, very interesting topic that you talked about the middle ground, your hunt for the middle ground, which I found fascinating because it is such a, it's almost like the dodo bird in today's age, you know. The middle ground doesn't seem to exist in public discourse. And it's both interesting and it's fucking frightening for me that there doesn't seem, it's not as easy to find, whereas it used to be something that we would just assume would always be there. Is the hunt for the middle ground viable in any level of public discourse? I mean, I know comedies always makes it easier to discuss difficult things, but you've attempted it. You're attempting it. Are you finding that it's viable?
That's such an interesting question because you're right. Like, comedy really benefits on certainties and rhythms, you know. And it's like if a comic sees it this way, it is that thudum, thudum, and we're on the boat together. We're going this way, and bum ba bum ba bum ba bum ba bang. So with the middle ground, it's bum, 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 bum. Like, so it is slightly less palatable. But what I try and do is go bum, ba-dum, ba-dum, and then, you know, and just like find what I think. And it might not be that I sort of oscillate within one subject, but I might pick different subjects and have a different take on certain things. But yeah, it's really that's the challenge, isn't it? Because also it's like what frustrates me at the minute is that everything, it feels very tribal, and it's kind of like, if, like, for example, if you're, I was thinking this today because we're in Singapore, and I was watching a bunch of, there was an American lady at the buffet, and she was so lovely. She was so sweet. She was talking to this guy, and she was like, "Can I have a cappuccino, please?" And the guy was like, "Okay, in a minute." And she was like, "Do it whenever you want. I'm in no rush. I'm on vacation." And she was like the sweetest lady. And I was just thinking, like, you sort of forget, because of the past 2 weeks, we're in this kind of blizzard where we think all Americans are like Trump obsessed, kind of USA, you know, and. And it was just this moment where you go, God, it must be so bad for, it must be so awful for a traveling American
to be painted with the same brush all the time. Yeah, yeah.
Painted by the same brush. And again, yeah. it was that, you know, I was going, God, it was so, so I find that very, I find talking about Trump an interesting thing, because you just feel compelled, or I do.
Oh, it's a fascinating topic. Trumpism is a fascinating topic.
But you just can't leave it alone, but it's so nuanced, and it's so, it feels connected to everything, and it feels connected to, you know, mobile phones and climate change and
TikTok.
Yeah. Just, like, and,
just everything.
And attention span, and, you know what I mean? It just feels like everything is sort of immersed, and he just feels like this kind of, you know, and the sort of rise of the far right and sort of history and, you know.
Do you ever feel that there's a danger you might drown in the hunt for the middle ground because people aren't really interested in finding it?
Well, I think the fortunate thing about drowning is that, you know, bear with me, is that I'm going to attempt a sort of a metaphor, is that if the audience are laughing, then you're not drowning, and they pull you out, and they give you a gulp of air, and you get to swim. And that's what it, like, so I'm far more interested in the, it's a process, isn't it? And you kind of, you're trying, you listen, when you're trying to put stuff, you know, particularly when you're writing new bits, you're trying to figure it out. And you're kind of like, it's like a sculpture, and you show the audience the sculpture every day, and it sort of changes a bit, and you move it this way and you move it that way. And sometimes they're like, oh yeah, put a bit there, move this. And you sort of listen to them and you create it with them until you're then able to step back from it and then go, right, okay, does that convey what I want to say? You know, so it's that's why it's such a brilliant art form, because you get to think, write, say, absorb. Think, write, say, absorb. And, you know, over the process of kind of, you know, a week or 3 months, however long bits take to solidify, that's the process. And then you get to look at it and go, okay, have I said what I want to say? Do you know what I mean? But it's kind of, yeah, it is slightly, it would be very easy to write pure kind of reactionary stand-up, but it's just not my, it's not my vibe, you know.
Would it be true to say that a lot of people first kind of started vibing with you through television? Was that your experience? Because that was, I mean, that was my experience as a fan. I kind of saw you on Mock the Week, and then that's how I kind of
yeah
I mean, do you remember how, if you were in fact doing that, were you shitting your pants when you first went on that, like on a television show? Because that, I mean, for someone that's an unknown on a wider scale, it must be terrifying, no?
Yeah. Do you know what's weird about it is that you, because Mock the Week used to record for 3 hours for like a 28 minute show, so you, and everyone had notes. So everyone had, like, you know, 6 pages of notes with bullet points and stuff like this. And they were kind of under the desk, and you'd be fucking looking and then trying to remember and all this. So it was, there were moments when I first did it where in your head, your brain would go, you haven't said anything for 10 minutes. And your brain would be like, oh my God, yeah, my God, we haven't spent, now it's 11. Right, say something. and you say something, you go, well, that didn't work. And you're like, oh, fuck, fuck, fuck. And it was that. It's just this, it's like going on TV for the first time feels like losing your virginity and it's being recorded. Like, do you know what I mean? And it's just that thing of like, and it's going to be a sex tape. And you're like, what? I've never done this before. Do you know what I mean? And your parents are going to watch. So yeah, there's a lot going on.
That would be a very awkward sex tape, by the way.
It's terrible. But then, interestingly, Sean Locke, the late great.
Yeah, he's phenomenal.
Phenomenal comic. But he said to a friend of mine, he goes, the great thing is the producers don't want you to be bad. They want you to do well. So as long as you say eight funny things, they'll put those things in.
Yeah.
And that was such an amazing thing to hear, because you're like, oh, great. So it isn't about being, you know, incredible for 3 hours with stuff you've only just written. It's like, as long as you say eight funny things over 3 hours, you'd be fine. So it was just, that was the big difference, that just you, yeah, that made it a lot easier. But that those first times, of course, it was unbelievable. And what was strange about it is, you know, so I was like 25 as well. It was, I felt very young and felt very immature. But then, you know, working alongside like Frankie Boyle and, you know, yeah, Daro and Parsons and all that, it was so amazing. And again, an incredible apprenticeship, because I watched Frankie firsthand and just saw.
That must be phenomenal. I mean, watching Frankie Boyle, and yeah, it
must be just.
But watching Frankie firsthand and still feeling like, I've been doing stand up at this point for 8 years, and you know, I was headlining clubs. I was kind of, I'd been nominated for the Perrier, but I'd gone through a sort of a live evolution, and then it felt like this was year zero, because his honestly, his brutal efficiency was jaw-droppingly good. He was so inventive. He was so, and you just can't help but be inspired.
Yeah.
You know, at 26, it felt a bit like, you know, again, to bring it back to football, of just going like this, just having like a foreign signing join, and you just go, fucking hell, look what he's doing with the ball. It was so it basically made me double down to try and see if I could compete.
Yeah.
And because that's what it felt like. He was so good and so funny and so, you know, in charge of his instrument. It was, but I also, that was the other thing. I've always been very, I've had no shame in laughing at people. So that was the other thing. So you were, not only were you scared, but then Frankie would say something hilarious and you just laugh and it would just relax you. And then you'd, you know, it's like with mates, you then join in with a laugh.
Yeah.
And you, so it was sort of that. It was a really weird experience of like, going, fucking hell, I'm terrified. That was really funny. I'm relaxed. Like, do you know what I mean? And, you know, so it was a strange one, man.
Well, Russell, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. And it'll be
really enjoyed that, man.
It'll be a pleasure to see you again live. It's been a while for me. So thank you so, so much for your time. It's been great.
Pleasure. I enjoyed that. Thanks, man.
Thank you. Take care. Bye. Goodbye.
Λοιπόν, αυτό ήταν το τέλος της πρώτης έτσι μεγάλης συνέντευξης του Κοινωνικά Ανέτοιμου. Πρώτη μεγάλη συνέντευξη στο νέο αυτό χώρο που, όπως βλέπετε, είναι ανέτοιμος κι αυτός, αλλά θα ετοιμαστεί με τον καιρό. Είναι περίεργη η αίσθηση, περίεργη. Περίεργη γιατί η πρώτη συνέντευξη που κάνουμε εδώ πέρα και για τον Κοινωνικά Ανέτοιμο και στο καινούριο έτσι στούντιο, το σπίτι της Sacred Belt, είναι μια συνέντευξη με ένα πολύ μεγάλο κωμικό, κατά με τουλάχιστον ένας πολύ μεγάλος κωμικός. Οπότε είναι περίεργη αίσθηση. Εγώ θα περίμενα ότι θα ξεκινήσουμε από πιο χαμηλά, αλλά πατήσαμε γκάζι λίγο απότομα. Έστω και αν δεν είναι σε θέση να εκτιμήσει μερικές από τις λεπτομέρειες που υπάρχουν εδώ πίσω, τι να ξέρει ο άσχετος. Και να σου να τον βρίζω. Θα πεις τίποτα για εδώ πίσω που φτιάξαμε εδώ πέρα, ολόκληρη ιστορία. Κύριε Άγγλε, Τίποτα δεν εκτιμάται. Να δω, ορίστε τι έχει γίνει εδώ, φωτάκια έχουμε βάλει, φάσματα, ράφια. Τίποτα. Δεν θα πεις τίποτα. Που μου καθόσουν από πίσω μια κουρτίνα και μου το έπαιζες μάγκας από τη Σιγκαπούρη. Εδώ κοίτα. Κοίτα εδώ. Τοξότες έχουμε, φώτα έχουμε. Παναγίτσα εδώ έχουμε, δεν φαίνεται. Έχουν Παναγίτσα εδώ από κάτω. Δεν, για κάποιο λόγο. Οι προηγούμενοι ιδιοκτήτες μας αφήσαν το γραφείο. Καλοσύνη τους. Αυτά.